The School Is Out podcast with Mike and Miles. We're all about asking questions and finding solutions for all things education. School is out. Now let's get started.
Hey, Miles.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, we're still in our strategies to get it done series. And this week we came up with a strategy on, it's a buzzword that every educator knows, every educator has experienced, but I don't know how many have really dived into differentiation. I know we've talked about this a couple times before, but let's talk about some strategies to truly differentiate learning for individuals in a classroom.
Yeah, I think this is great. Like you said, it's a buzzword, differentiation, to differentiate instruction, assessment, what goes on. And I think it's very difficult for teachers to do this. So if we can give practical strategies, we're going to give everyone something to help get it done.
Yeah. And I guess to lead us off with this, the first thing that comes to mind is I want to throw out a couple non-examples, things that I've heard or seen as differentiated that I don't necessarily feel are true differentiated ways of approaching learning. So having two different worksheets per se, having the worksheet that's unedited and then having a worksheet that might have a word bank with like a few words crossed out, or having a worksheet that's like skeleton notes and then having some of those notes already filled in. To me, that is not differentiated. That's an accommodation. That is barely an accommodation when it comes to a worksheet or per se, or, you know, and another accommodation that I feel is not necessarily differentiated is offering more time to get something done. I don't see that as a true differentiation of instruction. So I'm going to give the class a day to get this project done. I'm going to give you 2 days to get this project done. My thing is that, you know, time is very rarely differentiated. That's an accommodation for some learners. But again, that's, to me, that's something that's thrown around more whole group than individually.
So Mike, let's take a moment then for us to define what a differentiated classroom just looks like first. Those are things that we both agree are not differentiated. I know that this is something that a lot of teachers struggle with, of how to do this. So first, what is it?
In my eyes, a differentiated classroom is something that tries to hone in on more of an individual goal for their learning. But at the same time, we know that in a lot of classrooms, we have sizes, we have numbers of kids that makes differentiation very difficult. When we get up in the realms of 20 plus students in a classroom, becoming differentiated or doing that as an instructional model is more difficult. It takes a lot more planning. So immediately I start to see small groups. I see pods of students within a classroom, small groups of three or four sitting together. And then we, in my opinion, we create goals for the individual, goals for the small group, goals for the class. And then how does one relate to the other? When we get kids talking about those things and discussing my personal goal with my pod's goal, and then maybe my pod's goal with the class goal, that's engaging that learner in what they're doing and having them compare those three things. That's higher level thinking in my world. So when I present a lesson to the group as a whole, how does the pod now take that lesson? So I might have the entire class listening to my 10-minute lesson on math facts or on a math concept. Then after that 10 minutes, how would you as a group work within this, working together collaboratively on solving 1, 2, 3 issues about what I just taught you? Now, again, how would you as an individual take what you heard as a whole group, take how you practice as a small group, and relate that to your own personal goal for learning? That to me is differentiation. But as a teacher, when I see all of those things going on, and again, there is incredible planning behind all of that, am I listening and attuned to all of the steps, all of the output steps that are happening in that classroom? So am I listening to all of the groups to get an idea of, are you genuinely as a group working toward your goal on this? And can I hear the individuals in that group as well? Because that to me is part of my assessment. I don't necessarily need the output to be a worksheet or a written test to come up with a score for that learning. I'm keeping track of all of the learning by checking in with those groups, by checking in with individuals. That becomes part of my differentiated assessment as well. So that's where it is for me.
And what I heard you say, Mike, is really closely aligned to my understanding of this, or what it is for me first. It's each student is taught and assessed individually.
Yes.
When I say that, and when you were going over some of those things, this is where the problem lies, that teachers struggle with doing individual activities for, let's say, a group of 20 individuals all the time. That's where they struggle. And we approach all of these topics practically. We were in classrooms. We understand the struggle of classroom practice. Quick story from my past. I was first presented with the concept of differentiation as a young teacher. We had people come in, speakers, this is what this model looks like. This is how education is moving. Shows you how old I am, maybe. And when I first heard this, it was eye-opening to me. And I fully embraced this concept because it aligned with, you know, some of my overall vision for education, that it should be individual, that we're not in this mass system. So, and I remember in some of the reading that I had associated with this and from the presenter, they said assessment looks different in differentiated classrooms. You don't just use A, B, C, D, F to assess students. And I remember when that presentation was going on, I raised my hand. I said, then why are we moving to this differentiated model while maintaining our standard grading system? And this was something that was from outside the school district. He said, that's up to your district. So, you know, at times, and that's the rub for teachers, at times you're being asked to do things that don't quite fully fit in to the model or the framework that you have to work within. And it's a challenge as an educator. So then what did I do? I was a language arts teacher, high school language arts teacher, and I was getting ready to teach my next novel unit. And in my class, I had all different reading abilities, right? And all different interests. So I took this model and I created three different sets of discussion questions for every chapter of that novel. And I remember this. I was up until midnight of almost every weeknight creating these discussion questions and creating different assessments for these three different groups, because I thought that that's what differentiation was. And that's the way it was presented to me from this outside speaker. And I literally didn't sleep during that month or two that I was teaching that novel, because it was like so taxing that I was writing, if you can imagine that, teaching this new novel that I'd never taught before, but now doing something that I would do once, doing it three times. And when you're listening to me, oh, you're going to do this for 20 kids in your classroom, not that group of three. That's where teachers look at this, I know, and say, that's not realistic for me. So our strategies, I think, are a departure from that. And now we're going to talk through them. As a young educator, as a young language arts teacher, I did what I was being told to do, probably from someone who had never done it. They were probably teaching me about differentiation and had never even differentiated, because it was just this research concept. That wasn't practical for me. That's not practical for teachers now. So what are our strategies to get this done?
Yeah, so again, planning is the key. And someone addressed me, excuse me, earlier in the school year and said, so you're asking me to plan far more activities than what's in the resources that we have. And I said, I'm not asking you to do anything, but if you want to approach this concept, then you're inevitably going to be doing that. Yes, you're going to need to have pockets full of stop point activities that relate to what you're talking about. Yes, you're going to have to do that. You're going to have questions that you're going to pose to a whole group so that you can stop and and engage one of the small groups, but you, those questions that you pose to the whole group, you must be able to follow through with those things. You can't throw something out there and not have it important to the group, because then you're going to have a whole separate set of issues. And immediately people are saying, I can't do that because of the behaviors in my classroom. Kind of a tangent here, but we have to assume that time has been spent on your expected behaviors happening in the classroom. Okay, we've had episodes about that. We can talk more about that to anybody who's interested, but we, setting behaviors aside, we need to have genuine thought-provoking items that you can put down in front of kids in small groups or as individuals so that you can get to other groups. Is it ideal to have more personnel? Of course it is. Is it ideal to have special ed support pushed in during this? Of course it is. But if you don't have those things, you have to be able to let a heterogeneously grouped mixture of kids discuss at their own rate and their own ways their understanding of what you're asking them to do. And you must follow up and follow through with what they're doing. They need to know that it's important, that what you put on them was important, and that you're checking and praising their efforts for doing so. The other thing that, in my opinion, is key to this is if you're not this type of instructor, you must be willing to grade, quote unquote, growth equal to mastery. If you can't accept that, you are not going to be within a differentiated model. Growth and mastery are equal in my world. If you can show that you're learning, that's your grade. If you can show that you have learned, that also is your grade. If you learn quicker than somebody else, what's next on the docket for you to continue within this concept, or are you going to expand upon it some way? That also takes incredible amounts of planning. A differentiated model is difficult because if you're not the type of person that only ever thinks about teaching and learning, you're going to struggle with this because you're going to plan stuff around getting something done. And this is a thought process. It is a mindset. It is a continually evolving set of questions for everybody in your classroom. It's tough.
And it's difficult because, and I brought up that story that took me longer to get through than I wanted to for a reason, though. When that presenter told me that's up to your district to change assessment, and we didn't change assessment, and we're trying to cram in a differentiated approach to our traditional forms of assessment, then teachers, in my mind, the number one thing we have to do is we have to change our mindset of how we assess. And you just said this, with growth and mastery, we must change our mindset. That's the number one strategy for me. In my class, what does an A represent? In a traditional form of instruction, 100% means I gave 20 of my students the exact same assessment, and you know, this person was perfect, and this person scored a 50, regardless of where they started, what their needs were, or anything else. That is not how you assess in a differentiated classroom. A differentiated classroom breaks free of that model. It requires that the teacher identify what the individual needs are of the student, gauge where they are currently, and then measure growth towards a goal that hopefully both parties establish together. What is our goal for this time period for you? And then the assessment is, how much have you worked towards attaining that goal? To me, that's it. And if we look at our grade book as teachers and we say, well, you know, this person has to have 100 and this person has to have a 50 because the student who got the 100 did twice as well as the person who got the 50, we can't go any further. You can't go any further with this model if that's your thinking. You've got to break free from that. The assessment for the student only represents what they have done individually, their level, their individual level of growth and mastery. That's what that score represents.
And that model exists in our model of special education. And I guess my question is, if it works in special education, how does it not work in regular education? If you think about what special education is, we write goals for students. We try and gauge growth and mastery of those goals. If we've mastered the goal, what do? We write another goal. If we grow toward that goal, we say, wow, we made growth. We share that growth with the families, with the learner. And then we continue to work toward the mastery of that goal. There's nothing wrong with doing that in a whole group setting. Some of the typical pushback that comes back is, well, why would you teach this way, or why would you have a classroom this way when kids are going to take a standardized test for the state? That's not what that looks like. My response to that is a skill. That form of test taking is a tool that can be incorporated in a differentiated classroom. There's nothing wrong with using that tool once in a while to practice the output of learning. There's nothing wrong with that. But it shouldn't be the only output of learning, even though that's what's required of us by the state. Again, that is nothing more than a tool in my world.
And I'm going to say something that might be a little edgy or sound a bit controversial. It's not intended to, though. If you think, I would state that the very existence of special education points to the fact that we have problems in our system. We had to create special education because we weren't good at this model first. Differentiation didn't exist when special education was created because we weren't treating people individually. Now that we have this model, and it is the right model, it's how we should teach. Every student should be taught and treated as if they were a special education student. That IEP that exists for students in special education, it should essentially exist for all students. We should all, as teachers, be able to sit down and talk about what the individual needs are for this child, what their goals should be, and then work on having them accomplish those goals. And my assessment then isn't sorting kids out 100 to zero, it is helping you to achieve your goals. And my assessment is a report on how close are we to achieving these goals. And that's all that it really is. Right along with that, Mike, I would like to put another strategy out for a practical strategy for teachers to use in the classroom. And I keep saying these things, but it's because I think they're so important. The more authentic and the more real you make your experiences, the more differentiated your classroom is, and all of this takes care of itself. If I have a project where my class is going to, whatever, build or create or do this, it's by nature differentiated. I don't have to worry about, as the classroom teacher, making my three sets of discussion questions for my novel, or whatever else that is that sometimes seems so impractical for teachers. I've created this project. I know that my students, depending on their ability and skill levels, are going to get to different points within the framework of this project. It's already differentiated. And then I'm going to assess how they did on the project with an understanding of what their current skills and abilities are and how much they grew in accomplishing that goal and creating that project. You know, the art teacher that sits down and gives the art project to her students of creating this painting, it's differentiated because it's hands-on, it's authentic, it's real. The individual student, before they go to create that painting, they know what their skills are. They know what they want to get better at. They put it on paper, and then the teacher assesses not whether that's just the best painting they ever saw or the worst, but how much this student grew in creating this new piece of artwork. That's what it is.
Right. And I think that what it is not are, you know, doing the extension questions at the end of the chapter versus just the regular questions. Well, I differentiated because I made that kid do the extension questions because they're in the gifted program or whatnot. So there's a lot more to it than that. Peel it back to its most simple and raw form. Take teaching off the table And imagine for a second that we have a group, any group, think in your head of any group size that's comfortable for you. You have something in your head that you want to teach somebody or some people. You want to talk about this and you want them to have an interest in it so that they can explore it for themselves. How many people do you think that you could do that with right away? Is it one? Is it two? Maybe. Maybe you have your kid and their best friend over, and you want to show them something about a fossil that you found in the backyard. And maybe that fossil fits a curriculum, or we can kind of go along with the story. It's not too hard to follow. How many more kids could you bring into the interest level of what you're about to share with them? And what number then becomes too many? How many people is too many for you to get your interest on what this is across to them and have them create this spark within themselves to go explore it on their own? If 20 is too many people, then we immediately need to break that 20 into different groups of people, into smaller groups of people, so that you can reach them all a little bit more intimately. But maybe 20 isn't a large group of people. Maybe you could do 30 or 40. I've seen speakers talk to hundreds or even thousands of people who are interested because they came of their own free will. Did they naturally have that free will, or was it developed? Teaching in itself is a differentiated experience. There's no, we have to get away from this model of factory workers in front of me, and I'm going to deliver some sort of instruction that fits everybody, and you all are expected to go out and make the same thing of what I show you. You know, my role is to instruct what's in this book. Your role is to learn it and regurgitate it back to me. No, those days are over. They've been long over. And it's not what works. Universities are getting away from that. Schools are getting away from that. The professional world doesn't exist like that. The professional world for professional development is very singular. Why are we continuing to do this? Because I think it's what's easier for systems and adults to do. We've got to get back to where it's not, we don't care about what's easier for systems and adults. We do what's best for kids to get them to learn at their maximum and to achieve growth leading toward mastery, like we said.
Following up on what you said, Mike, I want to say a couple of things. When I say this, a lot of people look at me with like googly eyes. We should be able to teach a group of students all together, regardless of who they are, where they come from the very top skill and ability level to the very bottom skill and ability level, 12th grade to K. We should be able to put a group of students in a room and teach them together. And we can. And think about why we have this system. We have it because, like I've said, learning is social. You learn so much from each other. That kid in the classroom that's at the top skill and ability wise can and will learn things from the student who is at the bottom skill and ability wise. But we don't need those 20 people to all get to the same place anyways. We right now, if we're not differentiating, teach all learners like they're going to the exact same place, and they're not. Every single student in our classroom is not going to be a surgeon. That's fine to say, but we want to be able to teach the ones who are going to become surgeons like they're going to become a surgeon, and be able to teach the ones who are going to become a great artist like they're going to become a great artist in the same classroom. Let me extend your analogy one step further. Let's say I'm getting ready to coach a Little League baseball team. Okay. I got 15 kids and I've got 9 positions on the baseball diamond. And my first practice, I got the kids out and we're playing catch. Well, all of those kids are going to play different positions on the baseball field. I need all of those kids to win and be successful. But if every practice that I go through, I coach and run my practice like everyone's going to be the shortstop, and I've got one kid on my team that's been playing baseball for 5 years and looks great, and I just gear my practice towards that kid and just train everyone like they're going to be shortstop, I got 8 other positions and I'm never going to win a Little League baseball game. but that's how we teach. So the strategy to get it done, remember the baseball diamond in your head and assess where all your kids are and what they need. You're going to have some kids that don't know what a baseball glove is. Well, you got to teach that kid what a baseball glove is, while at the same time, you're challenging that kid who's played baseball for 5 years and looks like a star, and keep challenging him too. And yes, it is possible, because that happens in Little League baseball. And you see that happen all the time. That's life. Be real. Teach like it's life.
And can this happen in a high school calculus class? Yes, it should happen in a high school calculus class. It should happen in a middle school home economics class. It should happen in a kindergarten class. If this is the model that should be happening everywhere. And if you think you can't do it, start to think about ways that you can. Start to get out of your own way and think about, how am I going to approach my kids in this class as people who are important to me? And it's important that I have something that they need, and I'm going to show them what that is in a way that they understand it, in a way that they can grow with it. That is the mindset. The mindset can no longer be, my job and my paycheck comes from delivering the material in this book to that crowd, and how they react to it is none of my care or my business. It is your business. Teaching and learning are our business. That's what we do. Make sure that you're engaging in both aspects of that. The learning, like, the must constant, be the output.
The constant refrain that I keep hearing from your words today is student-centered. I've been thinking about that so much lately, but all learning is student-centered. Like, you are starting with the learner. And if you in your classroom don't have that model, you've got to work real hard to get there. And that's where you find differentiation. It starts with the student and goes out. In so many classrooms, it starts with the teacher and just goes straight ahead in one direction. Like you said, we've got to break free from that. Student-centered, and build out. And then you've differentiated. And if you do that, you are doing what's right for our students.
Right. Teachers that work within the realm of differentiation, they don't ask the question what nearly as often as they ask the question why. Asking the question why about all of your students will get you a richer understanding of how to engage them personally and measure their growth and mastery. Starting asking questions like what, that's going to get you nowhere.
And before we wrap up this discussion, Mike, one thing that I've heard you continually say, I think is so spot on. You said in any group, there is a bell curve. And in the discussion of differentiation, for me, I hear a lot of times tracking. I hear tracking running around in my head, and I am anti-tracking, anti-ability grouping at any level of education, to be quite honest with you. I am, and I would challenge anyone to find some research that would refute my position on that. But talk through a little bit, Mike, what you've said on this idea that any group, there's a bell curve, and we've got to be able to teach to both ends of that in any group.
Yeah, so let's say I have a small group, and inside that group, I have a very advanced learner, I have two mid-level learners, and I have one struggling learner, one person who doesn't learn nearly as fast as the middle and not nearly as fast as the upper. Within that group, everybody, like you said, is a teacher also. Everybody has something to contribute to that conversation that will relate what I, as the instructor, put out to the whole group. They all have something that will speak to their own person, their own culture, their own understanding of what it is. And we can then all take from that and then give back to the group. Because what comes from that, when that group dissipates and I engage a student one-on-one, I will I will inevitably discover something more than what was there before the whole group instruction, before the smaller group instruction. Yes, that bell curve does exist, but when we talk about growth and mastery, you're going to find that, because I said growth is the same as mastery for me. Did one person master what I talked about? Perhaps, but they might have mastered it before I had talked about it. We don't know, but they grew something in that conversation and in that understanding of the concept that they didn't have before. At least it was an understanding of who someone else is and their understanding of it. They were able to contribute. Everybody was able to contribute to that. The bell-shaped curve means nothing anymore. Because guess what? If all we did was find success in the top part of that bell-shaped curve, then what are the rest of the people in our community doing? Is everything that they've done to contribute to our community worthless and meaningless? No, it's not.
Right. And the other part of that, Mike, is that in your whatever you're teaching, or you know, as you go into secondary education, your discipline and your curricular area, that's a very specific knowledge skill set. They come to us with a wide variety of abilities in a wide variety of things. And we've talked about phys ed before. And, you know, think about a gym class. By nature now, in my mind, is differentiated. You have people coming to a gym class with all different abilities, all different physical aptitudes. And we teach them all together, but we differentiate based on some of those abilities. And, you know, you might have the very best top performing gymnast in your high school in a phys ed class while you're doing the gymnastics unit. And you might have someone that just really struggles physically to move around, and you teach those two people differently and you assess them differently. It's a performance-based class. All classes should be looked at in that exact same way.
I agree 100%. 100%. So I think that was a great way to wrap this up. We don't want to keep going on about it, but there are definitely strategies and mindsets to have in place when we talk about differentiation. It is what's right. It is difficult at times, but the payback when it comes back to a teacher, when you see that growth and learning, it's incomparable. It's apples to oranges. It's incredible to see when it happens.
Yep. And for me, the takeaway for this, the strategy to get it done is it's individual. Differentiation is individual. Fair is not equal. You find out where your students are and you look for that growth and mastery and create paths to get there.
That's it.
This has been the Schools Out Podcast. Continue the conversation and explore past and future episodes at schoolisout.org.